It's 106. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580, The Information Advantage. I'm Tom Rogers. Celeste Quinn is away for the rest of the week. Our technical director this afternoon is Jason Croft, production assistant Harriet Williamson. When is the last time you talked to your neighbor over the fence or got into a conversation with anybody at the grocery store? By conversation, I don't necessarily mean online or over the phone. We're talking face-to-face with each other less and less these days. Fewer business deals are being sealed with a real honest-to-goodness handshake, for example. It's been replaced by the fax or the confirmation letter or an email. We may be communicating with each other more rapidly than ever and sending each other more information, but we're not doing it in the very presence of that other human being. Author John Locke sees a problem in that. He says the lack of conversation and human contact is hurting us as a society and even hurting us physically. He's written a book outlining his theories. The book is called The Devoicing of Society, Why We Don't Talk to Each Other Anymore. He joins us on the phone this afternoon from New York, and you can join us on the phone too. Our numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455, and outside the local calling area, 1-800-222-9455. Your calls are welcome and encouraged. Once again, outside Champaign-Urbana, 1-800-222-WILL, and inside the Champaign area, 333-WILL. This was originally going to be a part of our segment, our Computers in You segment that we do the third Thursday of each month, but our regularly scheduled guest was not able to make it to answer questions about computers today. You will be able to catch the Computers in You program again the third Thursday of next month. John Locke holds a chair in human communication sciences at the University of Sheffield in England. He was previously director of neurolinguistics lab at Massachusetts General Hospital and a lecturer on neurology at Harvard Medical School. And he also did some work at the University of Illinois. Good afternoon to John Locke.
Good afternoon, Tom. It's good to be with you.
Nice to have you here. And you did some work at the U of I. I just found that out in the book.
Well, I did some work at the U of I, but not as a student. I was a research assistant professor in 1969 at something then called Children's Research Center that later merged with another center to become the Institute for Child Behavior and Development down on South First Street. And I used to think about going to work whenever I smelled the pigs.
They're still here, by the way.
Glad to hear it.
Well, welcome back in a way.
Thank you.
Over the phone, if at least over the phone. How did you settle on the term the devoicing of society?
Well, I'm trained as a linguist, and linguists use the term devoicing in a technical way, not in the way that I'm using it here, to refer to the occasions when a person is speaking and the sound actually goes out of, or at least the vocal part of the sound goes out of their speech. So if I were saying a word like pig and it came out pick, we would say that the G devoiced. And phonologists, or those that deal with the sound system of language, are quite apt to use that word devoicing. It seemed to me when I got interested in larger issues, that is to say, in this case, the loss of or reduction of opportunities to use our more personal voice and social voice in our everyday lives, that same word came back to me.
Was there, so it's in a completely different context in
this
book. Was there a certain incident, a certain trend that got you thinking about this problem and then prompted you to write this book? Was there something you can point to and said, this is what set that spark off?
Yes. I think actually it happened in my personal life, although I also was studying babies, and I noticed a few things about infants that seemed to make this issue come to life for me. In the infant lab, what I noticed was that babies begin to talk before they actually know any words. And it made me realize that there are benefits to the vocal interactions between people that don't relate, in fact, to the meaning that they're expressing with their words. There's something to be gained when two people who know each other or would like to get to know each other better just pass the time of day, chew the fat, as we say, gossip, and there are emotional benefits and psychological benefits from doing that. You can have the feeling that you had a good talk, that you were heard, that you did something synchronously with another person. And that can be quite independent of the topic or any of the meanings that were exchanged. So that was my infant lab experience. Then when I was in Boston, which can be a somewhat impersonal city, I used to notice that when I got on the train in Salem, Mass., the other passengers were all reading at the time that I stood on the train platform, reading the Boston Globe or the New York Times and or the Wall Street Journal. And as I got on the train, they continued to read. Some people put in earpieces to listen to Walkmans or tapes or radio programs. And they sat silently for the 30 minutes of the ride into Boston. And when I got off the train, a lot of them were continuing to listen to their radios. And then I would see other people that were talking on mobile phones or listening to ghetto blasters, occasionally people going by on the street on rollerblades. And then when I got to my office, which was in a building that had a concierge, I noticed that he usually watched television, a little tiny portable television behind the desk. And I thought to myself, you know, if a person wanted to say hi, they'd really have a very difficult time doing that. And so I think it was those two experiences together that got me thinking in this way.
You mentioned that it is important to separate those face-to-face conversations from the phone call or the fax message or any other type of messaging somebody else. It's the separation between speaking to each other, relaying information, and actually talking.
Yeah. Yes, I think that one of the great figments that we linguists have enjoyed is that language is a tool for the exchange of thought. And it is that, but it is other things too. And I rather suspect that it only became that in recent years or in recent millennia. And that when our evolutionary ancestors started out using the voice for the purpose of doing something that related to other people, it was probably to alter their emotional state, to show that they were friendly or that they wanted to warn them off in a way that non-human primates use their voices to scold or to appease. And that function of using speech to develop relationships, to increase closeness of feeling between two people, in a sense to service our relationships, to sort of stop by and say a few things, keep the relationship going, that's rather different from the informationally oriented applications of speech and language that occur so commonly now. I think those were really, there's no way of knowing, of course, exactly how long we've used language to be so informative, but I have a feeling it's probably in the last several thousand years.
Well, you also write about, in fact, the beginning of the book deals quite extensively with how we pick up subtle clues about people through their vocal qualities, not just how they look, but how they sound, emotional qualities, physically, psychologically, relationally. How important is that? How much do we get from just hearing a person's voice and hearing the different qualities of that voice?
Well, it's awfully rich. Occasionally one sees an estimate of how much information that is transmitted through what people call nonverbal behavior, which takes into account facial and bodily orientation and other gestural activity, as well as the voice. And the estimates are sometimes pretty high that nonverbal communication seems to be carrying the majority of information in some cases. I think the thing to understand here in relation to the devoicing thesis is that that information is critical. In history, you could never separate the sender of a message from the message itself and the recipient of it. The person was always there looking at the listener and giving them the message. And that was valuable because not only did the sender see the recipient processing the information, but the observing listener could place some value judgments on the quality of the information, whether the sender seemed to be sincere, nervous about something, possibly not telling the whole story. And that's really critical because information by itself can be a little bit dangerous. If you don't know who sent it, you don't know why they sent it, you don't know if they really know what they claim to know. You know, people are watching our politicians like a hawk these days because we desperately want to know, why are they telling us this and do they mean it?
It's funny you mention politicians, is that you mention a politician is one piece of evidence in the theory of convergence. You mentioned the word convergence in this section when it comes to our voices betraying our relationship to other humans. Explain what convergence is.
Convergence is a means of coming together that happens automatically and frequently unconsciously. So let's say that if I suddenly started talking much faster than I've been talking, if you were converging with me, you might increase your own rate of speech. Or if I spoke more loudly or more precisely, if you joined in, then you would be converging. The reason this is kind of important is that if speech works the way I've said it does, then you would expect to see some emotional and psychological correlates of it. And convergence is a good example. John Dean, during the Watergate trial or hearings, was in a sense caught converging with the people questioning him in the words that he used. And it's a very common thing. It usually occurs when somebody is in a subordinate position and maybe a bit frightened of the superordinate or more powerful people to whom the individual is speaking. Let's say if you were being stopped by a policeman speeding or questioned in a court of law, you'd really want to please that individual and unconsciously probably take on some of the characteristics of that person. The most extreme example I know of is the so-called Stockholm Syndrome. And during the Second World War, some of the imprisoned Jews were detected speaking more like their Nazi guards than you would suppose they would want to.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. John Locke is our guest, the devoicing of society, our topic today. Our numbers, once again, if you'd like to join in, 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, and outside the local calling area, 1-800-222-9455. We have a caller on line 4 from Taylorville. Good afternoon. You're with John Locke.
Yeah, good afternoon. I would like to respectfully submit that this you really hit on one of the most important problems, I think, this society is facing right now, living, I should say. And I recall a bit of news of some years ago that pointed out Americans are the worst spellers in the English-speaking world, and I think also from mass media evidence, we're also the worst users of grammar. And I think this all ties in with your thing about the alienation. I really believe that technology is largely responsible for much of this. For example, television, which essentially does our imagining for us, and the devices like answering machines, which I call alienation machines. I've on occasion visited friends who were fielding calls from other people, friends, relations, and just listening to them, and not necessarily immediately calling back. This kind of stuff expresses a new way of looking, you might say, a zeitgeist, which which essentially it's dehumanizing, and I wish more people, especially educators, would be thinking of the importance of these things, because I really think it's we're heading toward a kind of future which perhaps within the next generation or so we won't need pod people. We'll be our own best pod people.
Thanks for your comments.
John? Well, thank you for that that comment. You've said so many things that I agree with. I don't know where to begin, but in fact, you're actually hastening some discussion of other points that we probably ought to be making today, which relate to ways in which technology have been presented as means to the solution of various problems. For example, globalizing the world, creating one great global community. And in fact, there may be certain benefits from electronic communications, and that may be one of them. But I think we have to be a bit thoughtful about how we are individually going to respond to each of these pieces of technology as it comes our way.
And you made a laundry list, but a list of different pieces of technology, and the answering machine being one of them, that are contributing to the devoicing that you mentioned.
Yes. I mean, I think if one were to try to write a chapter about the answering machine, that might be a bit overdone. But I think, as you say, embedded in a longer list of things that have some effect, sure, answering machines play a part. If you take a look at how people use them, frequently they're used as a public address system so that you can hear who's trying to reach you. And there's nothing wrong with that. I think it may be a wonderful use for it. But it does encourage people to do something that occasionally that would never have happened in history, and that is for a person to decide whether he wants to respond to the voice of his best friend. And people occasionally opt out, and they call back, and sometimes with some embarrassment say, well, I was in the shower, or I just heard the last part of what you said. but they may not have chosen to take the call at that time. So we're getting a little bit more cagey, I think, as to which messages we want to react to, which ones we want to just file away. And there are lots of other things, of course. I call these electronic tongue depressors. the cash machine is a good example. And there in Illinois, in Chicago, the First National Bank has a fine, I call it, it's a charge, of $3 for that is alleged or levied for people who could have used a remote system like the cash machine or a telephone or a computer and instead went in the bank and engaged a teller. In England, there's a bank called the Abbey Bank, and they have a £1 charge for the same thing. I think it's interesting that there's this very short period between when a convenience comes our way, like the cash machine. They're terrific. I love cash machines. Not against them in any way. But when it comes your way and is simply available to you, and when you're sort of feeling that you really have to use it and can't go in the bank anymore, and when you can't go in the bank, that means you're just going to have a few fewer conversations than you used to have.
It's all a matter of convenience. We get these convenience items that are not necessarily a free lunch. We give something away in return.
We do, and that's really the purpose, Tom, I think, that I had in writing this book, is just to get us to reflect on that. I walked past a building here in New York City the other day, and everyone in the building that I could see was running or walking on a machine of some sort. It was a health club. Well, those people would have been out for a stroll. And if you look at a lot of suburban areas, the streets are virtually devoid of any humanity in any form. There's no one out walking. You get the occasional jogger, but you're not really going to talk to them when they go by. And there are just fewer talking places than there used to be, where people can convene and just have a cup of coffee and a chat. I suppose the Champaign-Urbana area is still ahead of a lot of other places in the sense that there are kind of truck stops and coffee shops and things of that sort. But a lot of suburban areas are pretty much wastelands when it comes to places of social convening.
You also mentioned, you touched upon on other evidence that we're not getting together with people as much as we have before. The decline, for example, in memberships in clubs. I mean, your local Moose Club or Elks Club doesn't have nearly the number of people that it used to. And one thing that I guess amused me in a way is that you mentioned that more people than ever are bowling. They go out to the bowling alley, but fewer people are actually getting together and forming leagues to go bowl.
Yes, that's Robert Putnam's evidence, and he wrote a very important article called Bowling Alone a few years ago. And that was he used bowling as a metaphor, of course, but his point was that the group thing just isn't what it used to be. Memberships are falling in various kinds of clubs. That's not too hard to find reasons for it. I mean, there may be underlying reasons, but the superficial ones are the other ways that we use our time. Television consumes about 4 hours per day of the average person's life. And there are just many other things that we do but they're sort of... I think mainly the problem is that people are kind of holing up. I mean, when they get home, that's pretty much it.
The cocooning
idea. Yeah, they are. I think so. There are more people living alone than ever before, I think. People can afford to do that. In England, they have a person that's called a SINMU, and the letters SINMU stand for Single Income Never Married Owner Occupier. And... that's a person that lives alone and has the money to have his or her own mortgage without having to share it with someone else. There's a lot more of that. More people living in gated communities where no one's really allowed into the neighborhood except the people that live there and their friends. Lots of folks, when they go home, drive their car into a garage that has a remotely controllable door, and the garage is attached to the house, so they just drive in and then they walk through a sort of a tunnel into the house. And there are lots of communities where it's not legal to build a house that has windows facing the windows of another house. That's true in England. It's true in various parts of the U.S. It's actually in the zoning that the windowed side of a house cannot face the windowed side of another house.
Quite a difference from years past
when
you had people, you know, handing things over from window to window at times.
Yes. So the old over-the-fence idea of relating just is kind of losing its zip. There's, of course, there's statistics to support a lot of these comments. One of them done by the Social Survey in Chicago, University of Chicago. They ask every year how many people, ask people if they spend very many nights with their neighbors and their friends. And there's been an increase of 41% in the last 20 years in the number of people that have never spent an evening with their neighbor. It's about a third now that have never spent an evening with a neighbor on either side. And there's kind of a fragmentation and an individualization, I suppose you could say, a privatization of people. And it doesn't bode well for chatting and neighborliness and community.
Our guest on the Afternoon Magazine today is John Locke. He is the author of a book called The Devoicing of Society, Why We Don't Talk to Each Other Anymore. Our phone lines are open, as always, 333-9455 if you want pose a question to John Locke if you're in the Champaign-Urbana area. Outside, if you're elsewhere in Illinois and Indiana, call us at 1-800-222-9455. Once again, 333-WILL. 1-800-222-WILL. You talked about the advancements in technology that have led to this trend, but this is something that, from reading the book, it sounds like it's been going on for a long time. You go back to the discovery of the printing press, or the invention of the printing press, and the rise in literacy that may have started the ball rolling, and other things that precede what we consider technological advancements that helped lead to this trend.
Yeah, it has been going on for a long time. I mean, the people from whom we're descended lived in small groups of 40 or 50. They knew everybody. It would have been almost frightening to come across a person that was unknown. They also knew what each other knew, and so their conversations were necessarily not terribly informative. That began to break apart, I think, around 8,000 or 10,000 years ago, when people developed larger housing areas. Essentially, they invented towns and cities, and there were increasingly strangers who just didn't have the same common experience. And by the way, a very mundane form of human behavior is simply not possible with strangers, and that's gossip. You simply cannot talk with anyone about a third person if the other person doesn't know that individual. Gossip would really have a very unsatisfying flavor to it if you started talking about someone who did something recently and the other person had no idea who this was. So just the enlarging of the human group was a factor, I think. The printing press, certainly, because that was the first time, really, that the message could be separated from the sender, and the beginning, really, of some fairly serious ambiguities, which we're now appreciating in the form of flame mail and other things that go on in email. But that clearly got to start with an efficient printing system that enabled people to have inexpensive books and to spread literacy. And then I think you really kind of move ahead to this century and some things that are going on now and have been going on for a while, one of which is just the fact that many people nowadays are really pretty successful, and they don't have the same reliance on their friends and neighbors that they would have had at one time. For example, if somebody wants to take a holiday, they at one time would have asked the neighbors if they'd be willing to come in and water their plants or take their dog for a run or something of that sort. Now, I think increasingly, even though those behaviors can continue, obviously, a lot of folks are just more inclined to take their dog to a kennel and have a plant sitter come in or do something of the sort.
So the rise of the services sector.
Yeah, that's right. And the point is, you know, if you ask those people to do this, I mean, they'll ask us, and then now we'll be involved in something that we might not want to get into. And, of course, what people had to get into these things in the past, reciprocal sharing arrangements, were what it took to get through life. You simply couldn't live without sharing with others. And I think a person that's just of reasonably moderate means can get through a whole lot of life without asking anyone for any assistance or giving anyone any assistance. And so it's just fewer things that cause you to need to come together with someone else.
We have a caller on the line from Bloomington on line 4. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Hello.
I'd like to ask you something. Do you think there might be a possibility that people don't intermix the way they used to? Because of the society today, with this, everybody seems to either want to sue somebody or write a book, and one never knows if you've spilled your guts, as it were, to somebody else, whether you might not be subpoenaed to testify in a lawsuit or appear in a book.
I think there's something to what you're saying. We're certainly seeing a good dose of that right now. People in the U.S., and I guess more largely in other parts of the world as well, are asking, why do we have to have all this detail with regard to the Clinton case? Can't they just tell us the general nature of these charges without taking us through every little bit of it? Yes, I think that there is a tension in our society that's really becoming quite evident, and it's a tension between privacy and intimacy. You can't have intimacy if you don't have privacy. But if you don't have any intimacy in your life, you may be inclined to grab a little of somebody else's, and that will violate their privacy. And there's a very large industry, I don't know how many billions of dollars per annum, that is made simply by people who are invading privacy and selling that in the form of intimacy to other people. You don't have to look too far. The newsstand's got a fair dose of it. Late afternoon talk shows where people are parading the latest in psychological anomalies, I suppose. There are various places where kiss and tell books, we're really on the path to find out what's behind the scenes in other people's lives. I agree with you, sir.
Thanks for your call.
Something else I'd like to ask you. Do either of you know who was the one who put on the Internet this story about Henry Hyde?
Well, I don't know.
I don't know that myself.
It was in either USA Today or New York Times today. I read it in one of the papers.
Yeah, there's a question, I guess, as to whether it started with a report from somebody within the White House or not. I'm not sure. But thanks for your call. You did mention that you in the book, actually, you mentioned that gossip has its rightful place in society in some cases. Is this interest in the late afternoon talk shows and the interest in the, you know, what's included inside the Star Report, is that sort of us trying to compensate for the gossip that we don't share amongst each other anymore?
Well, I think that's true, actually. We probably could have gotten a fairly full dose, certainly the adult daily requirement, from the vocal interactions that would naturally have come our way some decades ago. Those just aren't there. We can't do it if we don't have the friends in common. And people are privatized, as we were saying, so it's not likely that we're going to know too much about other people that we do also know. And I think it's kind of the virtualizing of a lot of our society that we don't get it in our lives. We get it from some outside source.
Is our ability to form relationships based on one-on-one conversation, is that a learned behavior? Are we in danger of losing that ability with all these changes in society and the separation between us all, or does that ability stay with us even if we don't exercise it?
Well, I would think it would be there to be cultivated at birth. We certainly wouldn't lose it in any biological sense. We're a social species, and we critically depend upon it. But having said that, I think people are likely to be occasionally seduced into thinking they know someone when they don't. And it can happen rather subtly. It happened to me one day. I used the word know. I said, I know that person. And it turns out that I caught myself because I had talked to her on the phone, and I had seen her color photograph on the Internet. But I had never met her. And there are people, as you probably know, who are considering marriage based on some properties in their email messages. I don't frankly know what they would be, but I suppose people can fall into something like love from just the expression that they have for each other in writing. But there are lots of kind of false relationships, I think, that really need to be verified. Now, most of us that are using the Internet today or using email are using it with a fair percentage of people that we already know. And that's a sort of different situation. If you're writing a letter to someone that you know, they know you, they know what you wouldn't say, what you might say. If there is a confusion in the letter, they will probably resolve it in your favor. But when you're on the Internet and you're dealing with strangers, not so.
That's a caution that a lot of people hear when they first get on the internet and start using email, that you have to be very clear in what you write, that there's a very good chance that you'll be misunderstood because you don't have those other cues that may signal sarcasm or something like that.
Yes, that's true. And the sad part is we've got all these brain mechanisms that have been worked out hundreds of thousands of years ago, specialized neurons that only fire to the sight of a face or the sound of a voice, and we don't even need those and can't use them when the communication is neither facial nor vocal. And that can produce some problems, and one of them is distrust. And if you have too much distrust, you've got not only the possibility of a lot of individual bickering, but also a lot of things that will never get done. And, you know, when de Tocqueville went to the U.S. in the 1830s or so, he was quite impressed by how eagerly Americans joined forces to accomplish various community tasks. It's getting harder to get people to sign up for things, as you pointed out earlier. And the net benefit is people are constantly reaching their hand toward Washington, D.C. and saying, can you give us a grant?
Mm-hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. John Locke is our guest, who's talking on his book, The Devoicing of Society. And we still have a few more minutes left in our conversation. You can join in. Our number is once again 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, and outside the local calling area, 1-800-222-9455. And you did mention that our sense of trust is sometimes skewed by lack of conversation. That's one of the side effects of this.
Yes.
In what way?
Yes. Francis Fukuyama has written a wonderful book called Trust, and he's of course identified many reasons why trust might be ebbing in society. And he wasn't really talking about this, but it doesn't help for people who are going to need to be working together or need to be persuaded by each other not to know each other. There's just no real benefit. A lot of businessmen don't forget that fact, and they will fly 5,000 miles in order to have a cup of coffee with someone and then fly home knowing that they've at least established something fundamental about the way they're going to be relating. They can look into each other's eyes. You know, we think about Henry Kissinger's shuttle diplomacy. Much better to be there if you can.
It's getting that much more appreciated since we see less and less of it.
I think so, yes. And I'm doing some work in Britain with British Telecom that relates to this question of teleconferencing. And I think that what may happen in the future is that people that argue that they don't need to actually and really wouldn't like to go to conferences, they would rather just have multiple person teleconferencing from their office, are likely to find that they've had their company commit its budget to that sort of thing, and then when they really do want to meet, they may not be able to because there won't be the funds to fly to an airport and stay in local hotels and so forth.
Well, it sounds like some people are actually trying to resolve the problem. They see the problem and they want to do something about it. There are also other trends that you mentioned in the book, like the downshifting movement. People not necessarily looking for personal gain now in their careers and spending more time with each other. People moving away from the television set, the white dot movement, as it's called in Britain. I thought that's a very clever name, but are people generally getting it now? Are they noticing that they're not having those relationships and they're not quite as fulfilling as they were?
I don't know. I mean, I think some individuals have complained because I've located their expressions in various places in journalism and newspapers and so forth, in cartoons even. I think people are beginning to react, but I don't know. I think this book, one of my intentions in writing it, was to sensitize people to the fact that this can happen. There was an article recently by Robert Kraut and his colleagues at Carnegie Mellon about the effects of email on emotional depression. And it turns out that for those in a fairly large and well-controlled study who substituted email for regular face-to-face conversation, there was an increase in depression. And so I think that there's going to be increasingly a feeling of a bit of a chill in the air. And if you talk like this, of course, some people will say, aren't you just being nostalgic? I mean, everyone thought that things were better 50 years ago or 100 years ago. And I'm not saying that. I think that there are real stress fractures beginning to develop.
Are there technological advances that promise to reverse the trend and to get people talking to each other in person again? You mentioned teleconferencing as something that it's probably the most personal way to talk to somebody right now, short of actually going to see somebody.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're just going to have to see how barely virtual you can be, I suppose we could say, and still have the benefits that come from face-to-face vocal interaction. It could be that that the situation needn't be so dire. It could be that technology got us into this, and better technology can help to get us out a bit, so that we're talking with someone 1,000 miles away, but it's almost as though we're in the same room with them. I'd like to keep my mind open about that. I'm a social scientist, and I'd like to see where the trail leads.
In the preface, you note that you combine the scientific research. You've done quite a bit of research scientifically with quotes from just popular literature like Reader's Digest to back up your theories. Why is that?
Well, the reason I've done it is that I think we're on the cusp of something here. There really isn't much of a scientific literature at the moment on a lot of issues, and the issues that I'm referring to are the reactions of people in the way that we got a couple of reactions by callers today. When I was on the radio the other day, I got a couple of calls, and they were very eye-opening or ear-opening remarks. People are just beginning to notice things, and they show up in the press first. And that's why there's a mixture of scientific references and more popular ones.
I would hope that the Afternoon Magazine isn't seen by some as a replacement for face-to-face contact and conversation, but you mentioned that the people are turning to those types of things as not a replacement or a supplement, perhaps, to that need for conversation.
Well, I think it's true that this conversation right now that we're having, it's a very enjoyable one, I think, a couple of Midwesterners really having a chat, and there are people listening in, and those people are the spectators, and I think we feel pretty good about this situation, but it is also interesting that talk has become, for some people, a spectator sport. You pay, turn on the set, and watch them do it, and they're not probably doing a whole lot better than you could do, and that's the nice thing about having a call-in show, because people do join in. But I think some of these things, you know, folks can do on their own. The place where I'd say that it may almost be coming necessary to watch folks talk, it has to do with these shows like Jerry Springer Show or whatever. Right. They have a very poor reputation, of course, but because they have the kind of maudlin acts, people coming out that you would not want to have living next door to you or even in your home, and they're sitting on center stage and they've got an audience. But it's interesting how what they're really doing, I think, is trotting out in front of people who read about things in the paper, the opportunity to decide how they really feel about those things. And the audience hoots and hisses and hollers, and that gives you a feeling that you're with them and your community condemns something that you were personally thinking of condemning.
Right. Quite of a small portion of a very large topic, and a topic that's been that's very interesting, and I hope that people got a lot out of it today. John Locke is the author of The Devoicing of Society, Why We Don't Talk to Each Other Anymore. It's from Simon & Schuster. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, John.